Before we jump into today's episode, we've got a free resource you won't want to miss. It's called The Robot Race: Could AI Ever Replace Humanity? A thought-provoking ebook exploring the rise of artificial intelligence, what it means to be human, and how Christians can think biblically in this new tech age. If you've ever asked, can machines become conscious? Or does AI challenge our faith? This is for you. Download your free copy now at premierinsight.org/resources. Again, that's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast. Before we jump into today's episode, we've got a free resource you won't want to miss. It's called The Robot Race: Could AI Ever Replace Humanity? A thought-provoking ebook exploring the rise of artificial intelligence, what it means to be human, and how Christians can think biblically in this new tech age. If you've ever asked, can machines become conscious? Or does AI challenge our faith? This is for you. Download your free copy now at premierinsight.org/resources. Again, that's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Well, hello and welcome to another episode of Matters of Life and Death. As always, I'm Tim Wyatt and I'm joined by my dad, John Wyatt. Hi, Dad.
Hi, Tim.
And I'm very pleased to say we have a guest on the show today, which is Caleb Woodbridge. How are you doing, Caleb?
Very well, thank you. Thanks for having me on to talk about this.
Brilliant. Well, we're really excited to have you on, Caleb. Before we launch into the guts of the conversation, do you want to just briefly explain to people who you are and what you do?
Yeah, so I'm a freelance writer and editor. My background is in publishing. I was publishing director for InterVarsity Press UK, and I've also got a background in digital and technology. So I've done various web and on social media type stuff, including with Media Cymru recently. So a bit of a mix of creative industries and digital stuff. But writing on faith and imagination on Bigger on the Inside, my Substack, biggerinside.co.uk, and very much interested in what AI throws into the mix with all that I'm doing and all that others are doing in terms of thinking creatively.
Hmm. And that tees us up nicely for what we will hope to talk to you about today, Caleb, because obviously coming from particularly from a publishing background, you'll be aware of how in the kind of writing world, ChatGPT and the like have kind of taken the world by storm, and there's an enormous amount of interest and I would say probably growing concern about what impact that might be having. And so I was very interested to read on your Substack a piece a few weeks ago you wrote called Remaining Human in the Age of AI, a Manifesto for Human Agency, Creativity, Critical Thought and Learning in the Time of Generative AI. We've talked about AI plenty on this podcast. I think it's probably clear to listeners that I am slightly more on the skeptical side than Dad is. Would you call yourself an AI skeptic, Caleb?
Yeah, I've been leaning increasingly skeptical because I like technology. I'm interested in it, and when ChatGPT launched, I signed up straight away, and it was while I was still at IVP, and just a couple of weeks later, I sort of demoed it at a staff away day, where within the space of 5 minutes, I took a podcast, transcribed it, put it into ChatGPT, and turned that into a book proposal, sort of as a live demo. And sort of we were like, whoa, this is something we're going to have to get to grips with. And people were quite nervous. What's this going to mean for jobs? What's it going to mean for our writers and authors? What's it going to mean for sort of all sorts of ethical and legal stuff? So I've been experimenting with it, sort of, and before that I've been playing around with Midjourney and image generators and stuff like that. So I'm very much an interested dabbler. But the more I've gone on, I've been just getting a bit uncomfortable about the way it's been perhaps developing the itch always to turn to ChatGPT, perhaps before I've thought about stuff myself, perhaps coming to rely on it in a slightly unhealthy way. It just reminds me of how when I got a smartphone, I had good intentions to use it and not get distracted. But I know over time that social media, Twitter, all of these things have diminished my attention span, and there've been all these downsides to what in some ways is an amazing technology. And so I think we're perhaps sleepwalking into just the mass adoption of these things without considering those downsides. And so we need to much more critically interrogate what an appropriate use of it is. And there's some really scary stories of what it's doing to education, what's it doing to people who are kind of getting sucked in and thinking that they're talking to a real intelligent entity, and it's telling them they're the Messiah and stuff like this, and telling them all sorts of weird things. So yeah, there's some really weird and worrying stories and trends that I think we need to engage with.
This addictive tendency is very interesting, isn't it? Because I think all of us are well aware of this, and as you say, the smartphone is a very clear example of a technology which is addictive, and of course it's addictive by design. These things have been created very carefully to generate this addictive cycle. And in particular, what is so powerful is this internal triggering. So it's not that it starts off with things like notifications, where you get a ding to remind you to check. But the goal of the designers is to create these internal triggers, which is the itch, you say. You know, there's nothing, my smartphone is sitting here, there's nothing external prompting me, but I've got this internal itch that I just feel, well, I just want to, you know, I'll just check it. And that's part of this addictive cycle.
Mm. And for me, in the end, I cancelled my Midjourney subscription because I found it too addictive. And I think particularly for that image generation where there's a bit of a delay and the results are a bit hit and miss, and sometimes you get something really good, it does have that slightly slot machine type dynamic to it. And I found that although I was, initially sort of playing around and kind of like going, oh, perhaps I can come up with some concept art for my a story I'm writing on. Let's see what it can do in terms of that. And artwork to accompany Substack posts and stuff like that. There was also the element of becoming more aware of the ethical and copyright questions around how it had used, been trained on artists' work without permission. And so just becoming a bit like, oh, this is impressive, this is powerful, but there's some serious questions to grapple with here, both in terms of how it's been produced and trained and whether people are being compensated fairly for that, but also just in terms of the effect it's having on me and on my soul and on my creativity, and just not wanting it to have a negative effect in terms of those those things.
I find this very interesting because art is one of the only genuinely useful cases of AI I've found so far. You know, I also have a Substack, as people may know, and it is a trial to kind of scour the internet trying to find copyright-free images you can use to illustrate posts. And Substack has, as you know, Kayla, baked into it an AI system engine, and you just click the generate, write a prompt, and it's actually pretty good. And particularly you can choose, if you're not trying to kind of have photorealistic, but some kind of illustrative element, you know, it's actually really good. I can say, you know, what would be perfect to illustrate this section of the newsletter is I can see it in my mind's eye, and I don't have the budget all the time to go and hire a human illustrator to pay them to spend a day or two sketching this out, pinging me a few versions, and I'll finally approve that. They'll send it, you know, none of that's going to happen. But I can type the prompt into Substack and it spits me out four different versions. I say, oh no, check, put the tree in the foreground and make it black and white, and it happens. And oh, make it this look like it's a I don't know, it's in the style of a watercolor by Monet, and it can do like that. It's genuinely really impressive and useful. And I suppose it's quite seductive when you don't actually realize how is it able to do that. As you say, it's by ingesting the actual human created artwork of millions of artists without permission.
Yeah. So I think obviously with these things, we wouldn't be having all these debates and all these conversations if it didn't have useful applications. And I think a lot of the time it isn't substituting for like commissioned artwork. It's substituting for clip art or stuff sort of dubiously culled from Google image search, sort of skating over whether you've got copyright permission to use that particular imagery. I mean, I've shifted to trying to use photos and stuff that I've taken myself where possible and things. So like the image with the article is from a workshop that was taking place at Park Arts, a community Christian, supported by the church, and they have various artistic workshops and things going on there. So so certainly trying to find alternatives where possible. I'm not an anti-AI absolutist. I've got some people who I very much respect, and they say, no, just don't go there, don't use it, particularly because of ethical and environmental concerns. I think that's a very consistent position. But I do think that there are opportunities here, and probably we're not going to get the toothpaste back in the tube with this technology. So I think it is more a case of, okay, how can we wrestle with this and work out some parameters, both for me individually as a creative in the first instance, but also to have that wider conversation as a society. What are the things that maybe the platforms can put in place? Maybe what's the social norms? But also maybe having those conversations about regulation, and particularly what do we do about copyright and the right to train AI on stuff and things like that. I think we need to sort of not take AI and the shape it's taking as an inevitability, the way it's sort of just been unleashed upon the world, particularly in the form of these very much open-ended consumer chatbots and services.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the very interesting things about this development, is that these devices were just released into the wild, even without an instruction manual. I mean, yeah. In this sense, it's been almost unique in the history of putting a high-tech device out there without an instruction manual and just saying, go away and play, see what you can do. And arguably, that's very irresponsible. I mean, it's not rocket science to see the potential for abuse in so many different areas. And yet it seems that the race to get these devices out and to beat down the competition has completely overwhelmed the sort of normal safety testing and the way that tech products usually got launched. I mean, I'm interested to think about the writing process. I mean, all three of us spend quite a lot of time generating text and different versions. I mean, and here is a device which is offering to generate industrial scale amounts of text at a press of a button. Do you think it's going to find its place for people who are trying to write creatively in different, you know, fiction, nonfiction, commentary sort of thing that Tim does? or again, is it actually going to be, this is a terrible distraction which we've just got to set our face against?
Yeah, I think if you care about craft as a writer, if you care about your own capability to think and create, then that human intentionality is central. And I think one of my real concerns is, although there are helpful supporting uses, it's a very slippery slope. And so I think thinking through where you draw the line in terms of, okay, I think one of the things it can do well is as a better search engine, because it can sort of summarize and collate, and it can be more intelligent in the way that it gathers information and presents it back to you. Obviously, you've got to check it because it's not always reliable. It can hallucinate. You've got to treat it critically. But often as a search tool, I used the Google Gemini deep research thing in terms of as I was working on a book on imagination and discipleship and spiritual formation. I asked it for an annotated bibliography, and it gave me a really good list. And many of them I was already aware of, but it also flagged up to me some books that I didn't know. And now I'm going away and I'm reading them for myself. I'm not relying on its summaries to as the basis of my writing. But as a step in the process, I think it's got helpful uses. Now, then there's things like, I've done talks on the topic. Now, if I put my notes in from the talks and say, give me a first draft of this as a book, is that okay? I've thought about it beforehand. It's like, that feels to me a bit uncomfortable, and I feel like that's probably crossing a line, because in terms of actually crafting the individual words and sort of having that care and intentionality in terms of what I want to say and how I want to say it, then if you put in a draft and ask it to give feedback or to make changes or to go, can I make this more suitable for this particular audience? Is that okay as a sort of editing tool? That's a blurry grey area somewhere in the middle again. So I think there's a whole spectrum of how you can use it. And I think some of that stuff, like a lot of the time as a writer in the modern world, you're having to repurpose text. It's like, okay, you've written an article, now you've got to have the tweet to go with it, or the thing for the summary for that, or to have the show notes for the podcast. Now, is it okay for AI to do some of that work of adapting content for different things? I think that's probably okay. I'd always want to then review that and edit that again. But in terms of as a transformer of something that's already been worked on creatively, and then checking it, that it still reflects what you intended in the first place, but pulling out snippets and stuff, again, on the spectrum, I'd be relatively comfortable with that. But I think, there's a whole, I think different people would draw the line in different places. And then it's kind of having thought, it's having transparency, it's having agreed norms. I think for publishers, it's a real question of how do you handle this? Do you sort of start doing a kind of AI declaration where you sort of ask authors to go, okay, how did you use AI in this book? Can you still warrant that this is all your own work? And that is part of what contractually as a writer that you're saying when you sign a book contract. It's like, this is all my own thing, and it's properly attributed and so on. But that can get then tricky if you've used AI in the process. So I really think there's stuff to talk through as writers, as creatives, as creative professionals as well, between authors and editors and so on, just to think through some of the details of what healthy AI use looks like, what's acceptable, what's not, what needs to be declared, or what it should or not, what when in the process you do use it or not.
I think there's lots of really wise in there, Caleb. I guess my note of skepticism has often come from that in my admittedly fairly brief kind of dabbling in what some of these models can do in terms of producing writing, I'm relatively unimpressed by the quality. I mean, on one level, it's miraculous that it can do it at all, right, in kind of comprehensible grammatical English. But it feels to me like it's often kind of lowest common denominator. You know, it's kind of GCSE level essay stuff. You know, on the one hand, some have argued this. However, it could be said to be this. And I feel like if I'm a teacher teaching GCSE essay subjects, then that's a massive threat, right? Because it's going to be very tempting for students to turn in essays written by ChatGPT. If I'm a professional writer, a journalist, a novelist, a scientist, an academic, a researcher, am I really under threat from the kind of very pedestrian, anodyne kind of stuff that ChatGPT turns out? It can't really do real, sharp, incisive, crafted word, at least not the kind of models I've explored.
Well, can I come back on that? Because I would say I'm afraid you're out of date, and because it's all to do with the prompting. I mean, if you don't prompt it, you're going to get properly and carefully in a sophisticated way, then you're going to get AI slop. You know, you're going to get, you know, very pedestrian, prosaic, as you say, on the one hand, on the other hand. But with a sophisticated prompt, you can do this in the style of choose your writer, you know, do this in the style of D.H. Lawrence, do this in the style of, you know, and it's remarkable how effective it can be in doing something completely different. So I think that's the challenge, of course. I think these things are getting better and better and better. And it's becoming hard. Therefore, And so the positive argument is saying, so the creativity all goes into the prompt. It's all about how you create a really exciting prompt, which then creates the text you want. But anyway, that would be my response. I don't know, Caleb, what you would say to that.
Yeah, I was going to say something similar in that I think, for one thing, yeah, there's I think there's tools that are more optimized for creative writing, and I'm seeing sort of adverts for different tools specifically for creative writing, whether fiction or non-fiction. I saw something that's for a monthly subscription will generate 150,000 words of prose a month, and I was like and it's and I'm like, I don't know what its quality is like. But yeah, I think certainly the more thoughtfully you prompt and the more specific you are in terms of giving audience, giving the more you put in, the more steer you give in terms of what you want it to do, who you want it to be for, what kind of style you want it to be, the better the results will be. And I think this is one of the things where there has been quite significant improvement. Whether that will continue on the same trajectory, I don't know. The other aspect is as context windows get bigger, because one of the challenges of particularly book length writing is for a chatbot, it can't generally keep track of what's been said across an entire book. But I think as AI agents that work in more break larger tasks down and you're able to say, okay, do this, then do this, and it can sort of start from an outline and then you can get it to go chapter by chapter in increasing levels of detail. I think that kind of thing is going to develop and become more sophisticated. So I'm quite nervous about the idea of something where you can just give it a prompt of a few paragraphs and then press a button and out pops an entire book. I don't think that's a good use of the technology, because I think fundamentally what we're looking for when with these things is human connection. And this is one of the things I talk about in my article, is wanting to value communication as a way for humans to connect to one another. It's a relationship, not just a commodity, as Ellis Potter talks about art as a relationship rather than a commodity. Now, there's a lot of types of information, particularly factual stuff and guides and things, where it is more informational and it is more transactional. So perhaps that's somewhere where AI can play more of a part without it diminishing that. But I think even with learning, there's also a part of embracing the process of engaging with things. And I really worry in terms of like the GCSE student or even the university student, if you're coming up with this and you've never had the chance to learn to write independently of these tools, I really worry that that's going to diminish the independent creative thinking, the independent critical thinking. Is one thing to come in with many years' experience as an editor and to think how to use this tool, having developed those skills already. It's another thing for people to come and use these tools and think that they can then be an artist, they can be an author without having put in the work to develop their voice, develop their own ideas, develop these things. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I think that's a really important distinction in terms of how have you been shaped already and how is this going to shape you going forward if you rely on these tools or grow up with these tools.
Yeah, I massively share that worry, Caleb. I think it's interesting how, you know, I think about AI as a writer myself, and I say, well, it's either not as good as what I can produce, so why would I use it? Or even if it is able to produce what I can produce, why would I use it? What's the point of clicking a button and having it write an article? What am I here for? I'm not a prompt engineer. I'm a journalist. I'm a writer. I want to write myself. But that is in part because, I suppose, you know, when I was 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, I was reading voraciously lots of different kinds of things, and I was writing in school and other projects and learning how to use the English language, the written word, through trial and error, because there was no alternative. And then now I can kind of step back and say, well, do I think this is as good as me? Maybe not, maybe is. And if maybe it might be helpful somewhere else in the process in terms of brainstorming. But if you're a teenager now and it's just too tempting when you're set, you know, as I was, write a 2,000 word essay comparing Romeo and Juliet in Baz Luhrmann's film version and Franco Zeffirelli's film version and compare and contrast how they use the original Shakespeare text. You know, that was a really exciting project that I really enjoyed. But if you could turn the essay out in 10 minutes with a few carefully chosen prompts, you're never going to have the chance to learn how to use a language yourself. And then, as you say, you get to your 20s and your 30s and you don't have the choice that we are all in this podcast able to make, which is how do I integrate it safely without it starting to strangle off, because you've literally never learned how to write more than an email length before without relying on the machine.
That's right. And I think this applies not just to writing, but it applies to every single craft almost. I mean, so if you take the craft of medicine, I spent 25, 30 years or more honing down the skills, including the cognitive and intellectual and emotional skills of being an experienced paediatrician. But if the next generation of medical students can basically download all that cognitive content at a press of a button, you know, how do you create the next generation of really skilled human experts?
Yeah, and an AI is trained on human stuff. So if you have a generation who's dependent on it, who can't if we lose our capabilities to do that, then AI is going to diminish in its usefulness because it won't have the quality of human input going in to be able to deal with novel stuff. Mm. Now, I think there was an interesting podcast discussion. It was a talk. I listened to the podcast recording where Andy Crouch and Jonathan Haidt were talking about technology, what technology is doing to our souls. And it made the interesting point that just generally the trend with technology, the way we use it, is that we try to maximize profit and minimize effort and do that regardless of the impact it has on us as human beings. And actually, effort is often good for us. We enjoy the challenge of mastering something. Obviously, it can be frustrating in the time, in the moment. But as you go through that process and you get good at something, there's a real satisfaction in that. And it's through the wrestling, through the difficulty, that you really grow. I think if you're relying on AI, it's like getting a robot to come in and do your weightlifting for you. You're not going to grow the muscles. It's how do you keep your muscles strong? And often it's the it's the boring mundane stuff quite often where you have to cut your teeth as you grow in a career, as you start off in a career. So I worry that to the extent that maybe some of the stuff isn't very interesting or very exciting, some types of copywriting. I started off doing one of my early jobs was as a SEO consultant for an agency. I was writing all sorts of random articles for random companies.
Search engine optimization.
So it was like there was lawyers and letting agents and plastic surgery and all sorts of strange things. And I felt, what am I doing? And although it wasn't very satisfying in one sense, I had to wrestle with getting to grips with a new audience, a new subject area, trying to understand it. And so it was developing skills that were useful, even though I didn't really feel like this isn't my life's calling to kind of try and help this plastic surgeon rank higher on Google.
But that's actually a really interesting example, Caleb, because that, you know, so that kind of peak of it's probably peaked now because Google search algorithm has moved on. But there was a time when every business, if they wanted to reach higher up on the Google rankings and therefore get clicked on and get more customers, had to fill their website with these pages of text that used all the key Google keywords and that links to other pages and that had other ingoing and outgoing links. And there was this kind of endless arms race to try and hone this text that you stuffed on your website to appeal to the all-knowing, all-seeing Google algorithm. And this is a great example of, and often when you read these as a human, you would say, these articles aren't very interesting. They were written by a human, but they're not written for a human. They're written for the Google algorithm. They're written for a computer. And that is a great example of how human creativity was being warped and subsumed to serve the purpose of the algorithm. And this new form of literature was created, the SEO article, that didn't really serve a human function. It simply served a kind of commercial function. We were subsuming our creativity to meet the needs of the machine. And I guess my concern is if generative AI gets embedded in all our creative learning, then even the human-created content will start to resemble AI slop, because that is how our entire creative industry will have been reshaped to serve the needs of what the machine thinks is good and right and how we want to communicate, rather than what human-to-human communication desires.
Wondered if angel stories are real or just religious folklore? This month, Premier Insight is offering a fascinating ebook called The Case for Angels, Evidence, Encounters and Scripture. It examines real-life testimonies, biblical insight and reasoned arguments for the reality of angels today. If you're curious about the supernatural or how to talk about it with skeptics, this resource is for you. It's yours today as a thank you for your gift to Premier Insight. Get your copy now at premierinsight.org/matters of life and death. That's premierinsight.org/matters of life and death to receive your ebook today. Thank you. Have you ever wondered if angel stories are real or just religious folklore? This month, Premier Insight is offering a fascinating ebook called The Case for Angels, Evidence, Encounters and Scripture. It examines real-life testimonies, biblical insight and reasoned arguments for the reality of angels today. If you're curious about the supernatural or how to talk about it with skeptics, this resource is for you. It's yours today as a thank you for your gift to Premier Insight. Get your copy now at premierinsight.org/matters of life and death. That's premierinsight.org/matters of life and death to receive your ebook today. Thank you.
You're listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
The other issue is that if you think about what the problem that AI is trying to solve from a business point of view, it's the cost of human labour. Mm. And to some extent, it's the sort of logical end point of capitalism, and that sort of technological impulse is maximise profit, minimise effort, and human effort is the thing you have to pay for. And if you can take that out, you can save a lot of money. Now, you can churn, I mean, obviously the algorithms have changed. You can churn out that kind of SEO slop as AI slop very easily now, but Google is finding that they're on the back foot because people are turning to these chatbots for search and for information instead, which has its own challenges. But yeah, I think there was a sense in which there was a kind of information bubble in that people were putting out content not because it was particularly unique or valuable, but because there was an arms race. If you had to have regular fresh content that tried to be at least somewhat interesting and appealing to users in order to try and get attention. And yeah, I worry that in terms of thoughtful deliberate human work, with AI so easily able to generate stuff, that the human stuff can't compete in the sea of AI slop, as it were.
I think that's a very real phenomenon. I'm interested in your thoughts about the spiritual aspects of all this. You know, one of the interesting things has been said that attention is at the kind of heart of our spiritual relationship, and our attention to the Holy Spirit, attention to the truth, attention to the creation. These are central aspects of what it means to follow God, to be a faithful Christian. And how is this technology affecting this, the whole attention economy? Now, what's the spiritual impact of this? And again, is the answer to create some kind of technology-free zones in our daily lives?
Yeah, I think that's an excellent question. And I've been reading Ian McGilchrist recently, who's really fascinating on the role of attention in terms of how we engage with reality. And I think he explicitly draws a parallel between kind of creative attention and prayerfulness as in the creative process. I wrote about this on my Substack recently. There's a similarity in terms of how you have to be open and aware and engaged to the world around you both from the point of view of creativity, but also in terms of being receptive to God, in terms of being thankful for his gifts, prayerful, attentive to what's going on, what he might be doing in our lives. And I think there's a way in which we could rely on chatbots as a sort of substitute for the Holy Spirit, as a kind of it becomes the oracle that we consult with. I also think there's something dangerous in its pliability to our desires, and the promise of AI to be able to give something tailored just to you, and you can prompt and you can create images and you create video, whatever your heart desires. I mean, there's safety parameters put in around most of these things, but also if you go looking, you can find models that where the seatbelt is off, as it were. And so there's big issues there in terms of things like pornography and stuff like that. But for it to be able to be so tailored to exactly what you want, it's just extending the promise of the internet to its logical conclusion. Whatever your heart desires, you can have at a click of a button. And I think there's something deeply spiritually dangerous in that dynamic. And that's before you even get onto the question of, there's an interesting chapter in Rodrea's book, Living in Wonder, about AI and the demonic. And I think it's easy to kind of scoff at that at first impulse. But I think in terms of how technology might be weaponized against us, even if it's neutral in itself or not, it might have certain biases that in terms of the human heart, that dark spiritual forces can sort of weaponize these in terms of undermining God's design for human beings. And so we have to be discerning, skeptical to a degree, yes, but also recognizing that there is a spiritual battle, and whatever technologies we're using will in some way come into play in that.
I think that's really insightful. I mean, I think, let's be honest, most people, even those most listening to this, aren't going to be kind of professional creatives who aren't going to be massively moved by the kind of special pleading of people like us who say, it's going to come and take our jobs. Don't stop writing books. Don't stop being journalists. Don't stop, you know, creating. Most people are just plugging away with their normal jobs. But actually, if you are a pastor, a church leader, it is tempting not for ChatGPT to write your next book, but for ChatGPT to write your next sermon or your next Bible study. And then you enter into a whole bunch of questions of, can the Holy Spirit speak through a chatbot? Is the insight gleaned from ChatGPT into how, what kind of questions should write your Bible study around this passage? Is that useful? Should we avoid it because there's something unique about the Spirit only inhabits human beings? Or is this just like any tool, like consulting a concordance or a commentary or something like that, which I think is a much more, probably a much more pressing issue for your kind of common everyday Christian who's not, you know, writing and creating human stuff on a daily basis through their work.
Yeah, I think, again, particularly in terms of spiritual lives and engagement with one another as Christians and teaching and encouraging, I think that's something where the human dimension and the sort of listening to God is really important. And so I wouldn't say there's no room for AI necessarily, but I think that's a space where actually it might be a good space to say, actually, when it comes to our spiritual engagement, it is somewhere where we should draw that boundary and say, no, this needs to be human. This needs to be open to the to God's voice, and AI is just taking too much away from that. So I think in terms of having zones and times and so on for not using AI, yeah, your spiritual life is one where I would say that's probably something you want to protect.
One thing that I'm noticing is there's a sort of increasing move, both amongst some Christians, but also amongst others, towards a kind of trying to recreate a rural romantic vision of life, where we just say, you know, no to all of this, no to the machines, no to the, you know, we're going to go back to the land, we're going to be, you know, we're going to create our own communities. You know, I think of someone like Wendell Berry, who's been very influential in the States. But there are modern people is it Paul Kingsnorth? And so on. And I think this is a move. And at one level, I find it quite attractive. You know, it creates a vision of a back to the essentials, of saying a no, a plague on all your houses. But you know, as a paediatrician, I'm thinking, well, it's fine, you know, if we have this community on the land and we refuse all technology. And then what happens when one of our children become critically unwell? Do we say, oh, well, we can't use the technology, we'll, you know, and that's when it all seems to break apart, you know, that we need the machines to provide sophisticated healthcare, especially when it's life-threatening. And then, so can we with any integrity live a life where we basically depend on other people to provide the technology just when we need it?
I think that's a good question, but I think it's that question of what's this doing to us in terms of our humanity and in terms of our closeness to God. There's no diminishment in terms of healthcare uses of technology, in terms of that supporting human flourishing. Whereas I think many uses of particularly generative of AI have the potential to be massively harmful to human flourishing and to being in the image of God. We're created in God's image. He's the creator, and so we are creative. And so I think it's possible to draw those distinctions to go, okay, there are good uses of this technology, but is it helping us become more human? Is it helping us in ways that perhaps move us closer to God, or is it taking us further away? And I do think, I really value the challenge that people like Wendell Berry and Paul Kingsnorth, in terms of the resistance to the machine and to the dehumanizing effects of modern life. And I think AI is in a sense the just the most obvious manifestation, because if you want a runaway process that we've created that's a sort of paperclip optimizer, there's the AI thought experiment of, oh, if you create a AI and you tell it to create paperclips, and suddenly it'll use up the whole Earth's resources creating paperclips. Well, capitalism is always already doing that for GDP. It's an out of control system that we've created that we don't have entire control of, that's been massively run away. Destruction of the environment, destruction of human goods. We've already got that. That's already a sort of AI-like thing that has made and has had massive both benefits but also massive costs. And AI is just the latest technological thing. And with all of these things, I think we have to look at modernity as a whole with much greater discernment than perhaps we have done. And so, we need to consider a bit more asceticism in terms of our technology, in terms of these things, while at the same time not being complete Luddites and complete reactionaries in a negative way.
Yeah, I think the discernment word you use there, Caleb, is really critical. And it's a point we've often landed on in this podcast, that because, you know, clearly rejecting all forms of technology would be foolish and sub-Christian. I mean, you know, the Bible is clear, isn't it, in those early accounts of Genesis about, you know, that part of God's plan for humanity was to take the raw materials of this creation that he's given us and reshape it and use it to build things, agriculture and bricks and tools and all this kind of stuff. And at the same time, we are increasingly alive to the kind of insidious nature of some of our technologies and how they can pervert our humanity and warp it in unhealthy ways. And the challenge is knowing where to draw the line between the two. You know, to use Dad's example, clearly putting a very, very sick child in an incubator, a very specialist portable technology, is good and is what God absolutely wanted us to invent the incubator, and it saved lives. And then there, but other most forms of technology are going to be a bit more blurry. And I think the key task of the church in this kind of age of AI is, as you've been saying throughout, is to try and discern when is the AI interfering with and forming us or deforming us in ways that are contrary to the Creator's intention, in ways that diminish the image of God within us and limit our creative capacity. And when is AI actually just being a helpful tool, part of our, you know, God-given ability to steward and reshape creation? And that's not always an easy line to draw, is it?
Mm. And I think we need the range of responses, because there need to be some Christians who are really engaging and using these things actively to really be able to talk with knowledge and understanding about that. But I think it's also helpful to have that real critical pushback of, no, I'm not going to use this. And it's sort of then having those conversations to wrestle it through. And I'm looking forward to being on a panel at Keswick Unconventional talking about AI and to sort of continue this conversation. But I think it's a really important one for us to have, and the structural pressures of our society are very much to be to rush headlong into this thing. So I don't think there's any harm in going, actually, let's just try and put the brakes on a bit, to give ourselves space to think through these changes, to adapt to these changes, to have criteria that are based around human flourishing and not just the bottom line, and we've got to do it because it's there, because we can.
I mean, just looking forward, you know, as we come to a close, if, given the rate of progress we've seen, I mean, ChatGPT, I think, only came out in 2022, was it? So, you know, 2.5 years. And you just see the impact that this has had across the world. I mean, apparently it has hundreds of millions of users a week. You know, some significant proportion of the world's population is now using this on a regular basis. And all that's happened in 2.5 years. So, you know, as we fast forward, is it obviously we can't predict the future, but the idea that this is going to be massively disruptive to education, to the workplace, to, we haven't talked about relationships and AI companions. I mean, you mentioned, you know, the impact that that's having in your article. How can we equip, and particularly I'm thinking, you know, the role of the church, the role of the Christian community in what seems almost apocalyptic. I mean, not necessarily apocalyptic with a large A, you know, we talked in podcasts before about this, but with a small A, in the sense of a convulsion, but also a revealing, some kind of unfolding of a new era of human history. I don't know whether is that over the top, or is that what we are facing at the moment?
Yeah, I think the big challenge is one of discipleship and formation, and it's one of the things that I've been thinking about a lot in terms of the imagination. And I think we need to have the imagination to grasp both the challenges and the opportunities. And so I think what what the Christian story can do is to open up our imagination to go, the conditions of modernity or hypermodernity, the AI age, there's a bigger frame, there's a bigger story, one that is about our flourishing as human beings, about God's plan to redeem and restore creation. And it's how can we align stuff in the direction of that in a way that is humanizing, that's restorative, and technology used well can be part of what Francis Schaeffer called the substantial healing that can come about as a sort of fruit of that, rather than be driving towards the machine, towards dehumanization, towards all these destructive tendencies. So I think it's very much forming our imaginations, forming our character, forming who we are, and having a real depth so that as we face the technological upheavals, probably social, political, environmental upheavals of the 21st century, we can do that with courage and kindness rather than turning on one another with fear and tribalism, which this technology very much has the potential to inflame.
And just a final thought, I was really struck by your closing point in your kind of manifesto about remaining human in the age of AI, which makes the argument that collective action is needed here, that it's all very well saying we must all take personal responsibility for not letting AI erode our creative capacities. But fundamentally, as with almost all things when it comes to kind of digital internet technology, this is a collective action problem. There's no real good in each of us individually saying I'm going to try and curb my AI use if that isn't taken on a kind of million plus scale. And so I feel like this is actually a real calling on the church, as this is a pre-existing community of people whose values should lead them towards, I would argue, a degree of AI skepticism. And if it's a collective action problem, the church can be the crucible to kind of form that collective, to form that group of people, that critical mass that hopefully can bleed out of the church into wider society. But maybe it begins in the church saying, we're going to model a different way of life. We're not Luddites. We're not trying to be the Amish and, you know, unplug from Wi-Fi and pretend this doesn't exist. But nor are we going to just blindly let ourselves, and particularly our younger people, get kind of sucked into a kind of AI dystopia. And maybe it's the community of the church, the new family of the church, that can start to say, here's a different way of living that sensitively and wisely integrates AI, but in a way that has guardrails and that is contained and doesn't start to diminish our humanity.
Sounds like a good place to stop.
Yeah. I think it is as with smartphones, we've seen that it's very hard to resist the social pressures, like Jonathan Haidt's written about this in The Anxious Generation, and how if you're one parent and your kid is the outlier, not being allowed a smartphone in school, and that's really hard. So there does need to be, and I think he's right in terms of that caution over not giving social media use to pre-adolescent kids and stuff, sort of in those crucial ages of growth and formation. I think a similar caution is needed in terms of how we introduce AI for people as they're growing up, as they're developing their critical faculties. But it's something where if everyone is using it, inverted commas, everyone, if it's the norm for it to be used, then it becomes much harder to resist and opt out. Whereas if you've got a significant body of people pushing to put the brakes on, be cautious, weigh it up, then that I think is really helpful. I don't know how we gather that movement. I think that's something that probably creative people are perhaps particularly alive to because of that interest in there. But I think as it becomes more and more able to insert itself into more and more parts of life, people will find that it's impinging on their lives in ways that are both positive and negative, and it's going to be something we're all going to have to grapple with, even if it seems on the fringes at the moment. It's just becoming more and more widespread. If you've not encountered it yet in impacting your everyday life, you will.
Definitely. All right. Well, let's draw our conversation to a close there. Thanks so much, Caleb. Encourage you to go and have a look at his Substack. That's biggerinside.co.uk. And is there anywhere else you'd point people to, Caleb, if they want to engage with what you're thinking and writing and speaking on?
Yeah, so Bigger Insight is the main thing. Also, as a kind of writer and editor on CalebWoodbridge.com, particularly around my editorial services. So if anyone wants a thoughtful human being who can help with shaping books and getting published and things like that.
Well, that's so 20th century, yeah. So thoughtful human being.
Yeah, well, I've got to make the most of it before everyone gives up on using editors and just uses AI instead. So I've perhaps got 18 months, I don't know, hopefully longer.
Well, I am very confident that Caleb would do a far better job than ChatGPT would at editing your project, so do get in touch with him, CalebWoodbridge.com. Thanks so much for coming on, Caleb, and thanks to everyone else for listening. I hope it's kind of stimulated some thinking for yourself. We'd love to know your own thoughts or comments on what we've been talking about, or any suggestions for things that we should talk about in the future on the podcast. You can get in touch with us by emailing molad@premier.org.uk, or head to Dad's website, johnwyatt.com, to find lots of other resources, lots of AI, but also other things to read and stimulate your own thinking. Or you can find out some more about my journalism and subscribe to my Substack newsletter on my website, which is tswyatt.com. Right, that's it. Thanks very much. We'll see you next week. But until then, bye-bye.
Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Warning, the following ZipRecruiter radio spot you are about to hear is going to be filled with F-words.
When you're hiring, we at ZipRecruiter know you can feel frustrated, forlorn even, like your efforts are futile, and you can spend a fortune trying to find fabulous people, only to get flooded with candidates who are just fine. Fortunately, ZipRecruiter figured out how to fix all that. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. With ZipRecruiter, you can forget your frustrations because we find the right people for your roles fast, which is our absolute favorite F word. In fact, 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day.
Fantastic.
So, whether you need to hire 4, 40, or 400 people, get ready to meet first-rate talent. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/zip to try ZipRecruiter for free. Don't forget, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. Finally, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip.